And so the Reagan administration has this. You have Ed Meese, who on top of everything, not only has he got his involvement with military intelligence, with CID and things like that, as well as being the top law enforcement official in our country. But on top of that, of course, the statements that the man has made come as close to doctrinaire fascism as you can get away with while holding a very high government office in our country. He refers to poor people as the so-called poor. He talks about free food food banks as being utilized by people who don't want to pay for them. He talks about criminals as, you know, the ACLU as being a lobby for criminals. He refers to the fact that there's no need for the Miranda rights, as we mentioned earlier, because if anybody's arrested by the police, they must be guilty because the police don't arrest people who aren't guilty. This, folks, is the fascist mentality. I just feel it's necessary every now and then to point this out to people. We are not talking about kindly old conservatives like your Uncle Walt, you know, who thinks, oh, I don't know what you kids are up to these days. We're talking about the paramilitary, fascist, racist, right-wing agenda that is being played out in Washington. And I think that that's an important point to make every now and then in clear Americanese English.
Couple of points to consider, again, considering the Reagan administration as basically the military government that the Aryan nations and their forebears had long sought. Consider that the vice president, of course, is the former director of the CIA, George Bush. Also recall that in connection with the China lobby and the John Birch Society, we looked at great length at a man named Albert Wiedemeyer. Wiedemeyer was the advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, one of the key figures in the John Birch Society, and it would not be an exaggeration to say that if you stood within 200 yards of Albert Wiedemeyer and threw a rock in the air, that rock would land on a doctrinaire fascist. Summing up his career for about 50 years running, and again, if that seems smug or glib, we spent a good deal of time talking about all of the doctrinaire fascists that he had associated himself with on both sides of the Atlantic and in Asia, in fact, not only North America, Europe, and Asia, and the kinds of activities that he's been involved in for a long, long time could be described politely as fascist. And Wiedemeyer was resurrected after having been retired since, I think, 1953. He was resurrected by Reagan to serve as a special military advisor to this administration. Wiedemeyer, of course, front and center in Radio Free America number 11, our part two of our Aryan Nations series. And, of course, the first Secretary of State of this administration was the former Commander-in-Chief of NATO forces, Alexander Haig.
Okay, reading from a short segment here from The Years of MacArthur by D. Clayton James, published 1985 by Houghton Mifflin and Company. Short segment here. It says, another group of six individuals who might be regarded as forming a second echelon of the MacArthur inner group by 1950 were, one, Lieutenant General George E. Stratemeyer, a distinguished leader of the China-Burma Air War of 1943 to 45, who now commanded the Far East Air Forces. Major General Doyle O. Hickey, the able Deputy Chief of Staff of the Far East Command, who would later succeed Ammen as Chief of Staff. Major General Alonzo P. Fox, a veteran of both World Wars, who had served well as SCAP Deputy Chief of Staff, and whose daughter married a lieutenant on duty in Japan named Alexander M. Haig, Jr. So, we see not only, as Dave mentioned, the Potter Gales, the Willoughbys, the Wiedemeyers, the Van Horn Mosleys, and the others all involved with MacArthur's staff and all going on in one way or another. It went into a prominent career of the right-wing lunatic fringe. But again, like we said, not lunatics, people with connections. But we see also another part of the inner echelon acquiring a son-in-law by the name of Alexander Haig, who has jumped over some, I believe,
250-some-odd other officers for promotion. It's worth mentioning that in connection with Wiedemeyer, too. One of the things that we looked at in connection with Wiedemeyer was his relationship to a man named Embick, a General Embick. And nepotism is nepotism counts for quite a bit in all aspects of society, but particularly in the military. If you marry into the right family, that can get you a promotion a lot faster than you could otherwise get it. That was one of the things that accounted for Wiedemeyer's great success in the military, the fact that a key general staff officer was his father-in-law. And it certainly didn't hurt Alexander Haig to have his origins with the very same MacArthur group that's been front and center throughout these four Aryan Nations broadcasts. It's worth noting, too, that Alexander Haig was chairman of the board, or actually maybe he was chief executive officer. Anyway, he was the head of United Technologies, a major aerospace contractor, one of whose subsidiary companies is Pratt & Whitney. The company, interestingly enough, as coincidence would have it, or is it networking? We never know. Sometimes we know, sometimes we wonder. It was with Pratt & Whitney that William Pierce, the author of the Turner Diaries, head of the National Alliance Neo-Nazi Group, and an associate of George Lincoln Rockwell, he left to join Rockwell from Pratt & Whitney. Interesting coincidence, if that's what it is here. Speaking of William Pierce and the National Alliance, and again, assessing the Reagan administration as the Aryan Nation's government and its participation in the assassination of Kennedy and our other, that is, the participation of its members in the assassination of John Kennedy and our other assassinations being, again, analogous, we feel, to the rise of Hitler in Germany, where assassinations years before Hitler's ascension paved the way for that ascension. Research credit for the following story goes to Mae Brussel, and she is the top researcher in this field. If you're not familiar with her work, you should be. Her broadcast, called World Watchers International, is aired twice a week on this station. It airs Sunday morning at 9 and normally is repeated Thursday at 9, but obviously, since we're doing this tonight, it was rebroadcast last Sunday night. Okay? And again, this following story concerns the National Alliance, headed by William Luther Pierce, author of the Turner Diaries, intimate of the Aryan Nations. This is an article from the Washington Post of February 4th, 1982. It's authored by Charles Babcock, headlined, Administration Wavered on Nazi Tax Break. And basically, this is a fairly complicated article, what it's going to deal with is the Reagan administration's weakening of the IRS's rejection of the National Alliance as a tax-exempt group. National Alliance, a Nazi group, had applied to IRS for tax-exempt status. The IRS nixed that, and then when the National Alliance took its appeal to court, the Reagan administration weakened the IRS's position in attempting to deny them the tax-exempt status. An interesting thing to do. Again, reading from the Washington Post of February 4th, 1982. At the time that Reagan administration officials were deciding to restore tax exemptions to racially discriminatory private schools, they debated using the same legal arguments to support an exemption for a Nazi group's publications that preach racial hatred. The government finally decided to fight the exemption, but on much narrower grounds, my mouth is starting to give out here, forgive me, but on much narrower grounds than it argued in the lower court. Thus, the Nazi case is another example of the complications the administration has run into in trying to police what its officials consider the IRS habit of regulating on public policy grounds not specifically authorized by Congress. In 1978, IRS denied tax-exempt status to National Alliance, saying the white supremacist group didn't meet the required educational definition, unquote, because its publications advocated murder and kidnapping of blacks and Jews. The group sued, and last May, a federal judge said the IRS rules blocking the exemption were unconstitutionally vague. While the government was deciding its appeal strategy in the Nazi case, the administration moved to reverse a 12-year-old policy and restore tax exemptions for schools that discriminate. It argued that IRS had no authority to deny exemptions just because some private schools violated the public policy against racial discrimination. Some attorneys said the same legal reasoning required that the appeal in the Nazi case, National Alliance versus USA, be dropped totally. In a January 7th memo, IRS General Counsel Kenneth Gideon urged that the appeal, quote, be allowed to continue, unquote. The week following the January 8th private schools policy reversal, Justice and Treasury officials agreed not to drop the Nazi appeal entirely, officials said. On January 18th, the government filed a brief in the case, but it dropped all reference to the public policy precedents it had cited in the lower court. Some attorneys involved in the case said yesterday that the reversal on private schools undercut the government's position in the National Alliance case. Not being able to argue that its newsletter Attack and monthly magazine Action violated public policy by advocating racial hatred, quote, is sort of like chopping someone's legs off and then saying it's okay to still run the race, one attorney said. So again, this administration significantly weakening an IRS case against the National Alliance that would have denied tax-exempt status. What we have here, folks, is an administration pushing for tax-exempt status for one of the most virulent and significant of all of the Nazi groups, and specifically the National Alliance, whose author William Pierce has written the Bible for the Aryan nations. Again, consider this administration as the culmination of these events.
And their tax-exempt status, National Alliance's tax-exempt status, is based on the premise that they are, in fact, an educational organization. Think about it. For a little while, it's real interesting.
Real educational.
Yeah. Yeah, we are getting an education here tonight, folks. This next segment, speaking of education and speaking of where people get their educations from and what telling comments that kind of information can be about their roots, is an article from the New York Times editorial page for October 8th, 1985. We have read this story before, but it's such a screamer, and it ties in so well with what we're talking about tonight. We thought we'd share it for you again, and those of you who haven't heard it before, it's a real treat. Again, it's from the editorial page. It's headlined, "The Elusive Lenin," subheaded, "Where Ronald Reagan Read of the Plot to Conquer America." It's written by Carl E. Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R. President Reagan was asked the other day if he still thought the Soviet Union was an evil empire. "Yes," he told Ted Koppel of ABC, "because of, things like the downing of a South Korean airliner in Soviet airspace." Moreover, he said, "Soviet leaders repeatedly proclaimed their global ambition, which is why, quote, I have often quoted," Reagan said, "Lenin's statement that, quote, we will take Eastern Europe, we will organize the hordes of Asia, and then we will move into Latin America, and we won't have to take the United States. It will fall into our outstretched hands like overripe fruit." When did Lenin say that? The quote fell like an overripe fruit into a televised discussion that followed Mr. Reagan's appearance. A Soviet official, Georgi Arbatov, denounced it as a Nazi invention once exposed by the commentator Alistair Cook. Mr. Cook, sitting at hand, seemed to smile in assent. When later asked for details, Mr. Cook said he couldn't recall what, if anything, he had ever broadcast about the quote. He had his own theory. The line might have come to Mr. Reagan from an old movie script. The White House press office wanted to be helpful, but it could not document the quotation either. At the Library of Congress, researchers found an old folder showing they had been asked several times to check the citation some years ago. It failed to turn up, as promised, in the Collected Works of Lenin, Volume 10, page 172, or in any Russian or English edition of the works. Also in the folder was a clipping from the Chicago Daily News, dated December 8, 1958, describing the quote as a fake, but giving no source. Just then, an indirect reference to the same idea turned up in a new book on South Africa by our colleague Joseph Lelieveld. He wrote that he heard the same language attributed to Lenin by right-wing generals in Pretoria. He said that they apparently learned it from a book called None Dare Call It Conspiracy, published in Rossmore, California, 1971, and avidly read by members of the John Birch Society. Thus prompted, I finally found what seems to have been President Reagan's source, the Blue Book of the John Birch Society, compiled in 1958 by Robert Welch. On page 10, his book says, quote, Lenin died in 1924, but before he died, he had laid down for his followers the strategy for this conquest. It was, we should readily admit, brilliant, far-seeing, realistic, and majestically simple. It has been paraphrased and summarized as follows, quote, first we will take Eastern Europe, next the masses of Asia, then we shall encircle the last bastion of capitalism, the United States of America. We shall not have to attack. It will fall like overripe fruit into our hands. So there it is, an undocumentable Birchite paraphrase offered, quote, often, unquote, as a live quotation by a president of the United States. And folks, if nothing else, certainly sums up the Reagan attitude, but more importantly, it sums up also the kind of thought process that went into forming Reagan and his people and that goes into supplying them with information. And also it goes into the very makeup of the core of the Reagan administration. So when we're talking about a bunch of people who take John Birch Society propaganda at face value, and you're trying to tell them that, for instance, as we mentioned in an earlier article, that the good judgment of the FBI and the Justice Department will stand between police and FBI informants, and they're doing bad things when they're infiltrating the Klan and the Nazis, when there's basically no difference between the ideologies of the Klan and the Nazis and the people who are going to be making those decisions of what are good and bad things that they should or should not do, I think you see, folks, at the very least, that we've got a little bit of a problem on our hands.
Just how much of a problem can be illustrated in one way by pointing out that the very book that Ronald Reagan is quoting on the air on Nightline, no less, the Blue Book of the John Birch Society, was precisely what General Edwin Walker was teaching to his troops in Germany. Edwin Walker, recall, was relieved by President Kennedy of his command. He was a divisional commander in Germany, and he was relieved of his command by President Kennedy for teaching the Blue Book to his troops. He had a compulsory pro-blue program, as he put it, and pro-blue basically was, again, Walker was fired, and of course his bitterness over that firing, among other things, appears to have propelled him into the orbit of H.L. Hunt and the others who effected the Kennedy assassination. It's worth noting that a divisional commander was replaced in 1961 for teaching what the commander-in-chief now recites on national television. Okay? And again, consider the Reagan administration as the culmination of this entire process. Now, front and center in the last Aryan Nations show, our number program number 12, Radio Free America 12, we talked about the paramilitary milieu the Cuban Freikorps put together in order to topple Fidel Castro, and we also looked at how the Aryan Nations fit into that element and how that element in turn did not topple the government of Cuba, but toppled the government of the United States, specifically during the Kennedy assassination. And one of the things that we're going to look at now for the duration of the broadcast concerns really how the Reagan administration represents the culmination of that whole methodology, the culmination of the Freikorps methodology. And again, the things that we're seeing in Latin America with the death squads, these mercenary efforts in Nicaragua with the Contras, this is basically just Freikorps methodology. This is a carrying on of the sort of efforts that the German army employed in Germany, not only to put down the abortive German Revolution, but eventually to subvert Weimar democracy, and to bring Hitler to power. So, again, as we look at the Contras, as we look at these kinds of things, this is a time-honored methodology, and the first death squads began with Nazi Germany. For the duration of the broadcast, we're going to take a look at this Freikorps methodology as basically the stock in trade of the Reagan administration. Recall now Frank Camper, the FBI informant who recruited, who runs a mercenary training camp in Alabama, and at that camp, the David Duke Company recruited the Klan and Nazi mercenaries who were originally going to invade Grenada and eventually wound up invading Dominica. Well, Frank Camper's been very much in the news because his camp has remained open and active, and among the people who have been training there are Sikh militants who have been involved in attempting to establish an independent government in the state of Punjab in India. There's been a lot of speculation on this broadcast and elsewhere, on these broadcasts and elsewhere, that that is part of a U.S. destabilization of India, the Soviet Union's closest ally most powerful ally among the non-aligned nations. Well, Frank Camper has been very much in the news because at his mercenary camp, some Sikhs who were plotting against the life of Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi were trained there. Also, some Sikhs who have been sought in connection with the downing of an airliner, an Air India plane, which exploded off the coast of Ireland with the loss of hundreds of lives. And apparently, these Sikhs definitely trained at Frank Camper's school. Information about that came out, among other places, in the New York Times of June 27th, 1985. This story is special to the Times headline, "Sikh Suspect Studied Explosives at Mercenary School in Alabama." One of two Sikhs being sought for questioning in the crash of the Air India jumbo jet off Ireland and an airline baggage explosion in Japan took a course in explosives at a private school for mercenaries near here, according to the school's director. The Sikh, Lal Singh, is suspected by the authorities to be the L. Singh, whose name was on the passenger manifest of a CP air flight from Vancouver to Tokyo, but who did not board the plane. Baggage from the flight exploded after being unloaded, killing two people. The second suspect, Aman Singh, flew to Toronto before the ill-fated Bombay-bound Air India jumbo jet left that city, according to reports from Canada. The plane crashed into the sea, possibly because of a bomb, and all 329 aboard were killed. Earlier, the Federal Bureau of Investigation is said to have begun a search for the two men for questioning in connection with a purported plot to assassinate Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi of India, while he was in the United States this month. Three other Sikhs who were said to have attended the mercenary school with Lal Singh in November were taken into custody for questioning by the FBI in connection with the purported plot. Lal Singh never seemed like a bloodthirsty person, said the school's director, Joseph Franklin Camper Jr., a 38-year-old veteran of the Vietnam War. He was just a good student and did what we told him to do, unquote. Let me read that last sentence again. He was just a good student that did what we told him to do, unquote. One wonders if he was doing what he was told to do when he blew up the airplane, or allegedly blew up the plane. Anyway, continuing, he said Lal Singh had taken part in the school's explosive ordnance demolitions training, which teaches the handling of mines and grenades. But, Mr. Camper said, we have never taught anyone how to build a time bomb. We have mercenaries in Africa, the Middle East, all over the world, he said at the school. What they do after they leave here is a different story. Well, again, it's worth noting here that the people who the FBI has been seeking in connection with an attempt on the life of Indian Prime Minister Gandhi and an actual explosion of an airliner and the loss of hundreds of lives, they were being trained by an FBI informant. Certainly raises questions about why they were unable to come up with these people. It's worth noting that Camper's school has since been cleared of all terrorist activity. The FBI said that this was not terrorism that they were teaching. And again, Frank Camper front and center in the Dominica-Grenada invasion that we just looked at an hour or two ago. And apparently he's very much in business and still doing exactly the same kinds of activities. And the thing you want to look at here, again, is the unnerving notion of the Ku Klux Klan, basically, or elements thereof, functioning as an extension of U.S. foreign policy.
And another man who is front and center in the whole Dominica thing, a man whose name is going to come up in this next article, you'll remember the name of Alexander McWhorter, Canadian Klansman. We're going to read a little bit here again about some more intersection between some of these Klan-related people and the Sikhs. This is from the Vancouver Sun for November 13, 1985. The article was provided by Ted Rubenstein. The headline is, Sikh Separatists Find Supporter in Jail Ku Klux Klan Leader. I remember this article. There's a lot of noises in it. Sikh Separatists and Armand Sixna. I remember this. The article is by Terry Glavin. Sikh Separatists who want a country of their own in India have a new friend, a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. And a prominent Sikh separatist in Vancouver welcomes the newfound support. In a letter that appears in the current issue of the Indo-Canadian Times, Armand Sixna, a leader of the Canadian chapter of the white supremacist organization, said, quote, we will support Sikhs in their struggle to gain liberation. Sixna, spelled S-I-K-S-N-A, wrote his letter to the Surrey-based Punjabi language newspaper from his prison cell at the Joyceville Institute in Kingston, Ontario, where he is serving a six-year sentence on a 1983 conspiracy to murder conviction. Daljeet Singh Sandhu, international delegate from Vancouver to the World Sikh Organization, the most powerful worldwide organization of Sikh separatists, admitted Sixna's letter was support from an unusual source, but added, quote, if they support our position, we should welcome it. Sixna wrote, quote, we are against communists. Whatever the red dogs have done to the Sikhs in India, we oppose that too. When I come out of jail, I am not too sure how much political work the government will allow me to do, but I wish to state that I never did anything against Sikhs, and neither do I intend to say anything against them. He closes the letter by saying, I send greetings for your fight for liberation and wish you success, unquote. Sixna, then treasurer of the Canadian Klan and fellow Klan leader Alexander McWhorter, confessed in Toronto to conspiring to murder a troublesome colleague, Gary McFarlane, the Klan's former security chief in 1983. Skipping down, Sandhu said that's the Vancouver delegate to the Sikh separatist group. Sandhu said he doesn't know exactly how the KKK can support Khalistan, which is the Sikhs' name for the country that they're someday going to found in the Punjabi, separate country. Doesn't know how the KKK can support Khalistan, but he said Sixna's letter is, quote, good news, at least something is supporting us. Everybody is welcome who supports the idea of Khalistan.
Okay, so one wonders whether Alexander McWhorter's efforts on behalf of the Sikhs and the efforts of Frank Camper in training the Sikhs are related in that both dovetail and cooperated in the Dominica invasion. In the Contra effort in Central America, there's been a lot of discussion about so-called humanitarian aid given to the Contras. Obviously, any money given to them frees up other funds for whatever use they'd like, so it's sort of a silly notion to talk about humanitarian aid. You can give them money for food, but then they can just use the money that they were going to use for food for guns. Anyway, in light of that irony, the next piece of information that we're going to be reading from, which is published by the Resource Center at Box 4506, Albuquerque, New Mexico. And the Resource Center has entitled a document that they have listing the various far right-wing political action groups or military groups which have been involved in the so-called humanitarian aid to the Contras. This article, again, from the Resource Center of Albuquerque, New Mexico, is headlined New Right Humanitarians. And among the so-called New Right Humanitarian groups that they've discussed is a group called the Caribbean Commission at New Orleans, Louisiana. I'd like to read you something about this commission, and it's their description of the Resource Center's description of the Caribbean Commission and some of the people involved. Principals: Dr. Arnold Ochsner, O-S-C-H-N-E-R, Archbishop Hannon of New Orleans, L.A. State Representative Woody Jenkins, and Samuel Robinson. Business connections: Robinson Lumber. Formed in 1979 with the help of pro-Somoza Nicaraguans, CC aims to, that's Caribbean Commission, aims to, quote, maintain, promote, and strengthen the free enterprise system in the Western Hemisphere to prevent totalitarian infiltration. Aside from anti-communist education, CC distributes aid to Contras in Honduras. Dr. Ochsner's father wrote the white supremacist book Dispossessed Minority. David Duke, a former KKK leader and founder of the National Association of White People, works closely with CC. So David Duke is still very much involved in his activities with regard to paramilitary efforts and mercenary efforts. Of course, David Duke, probably U.S. agent and recruiter of the Dominica invasion. And worth noting here that the name Ochsner, O-C-H-S-N-E-R, O-S-C-H-N-E-R, rather, is another name that we've cropped, that we've looked at in the past, again, in connection with this paramilitary milieu that we saw combining for the Bay of Pigs in Operation 40. And in connection with that, we looked at Dr. Arnold Ochsner's father, Dr. Alton Ochsner.
Okay, I'm going to read a short segment to you from a book called Crime and Cover-Up, CIA, Mafia, and the Dallas Watergate Connection by Peter Dale Scott, copyright 1977 by Westworks Publishers in Berkeley. And they're talking here about INCA, which is the Information Council of the Americas, formed by Richard Butler. Another guy,
Ed Butler, Richard.
Ed, excuse me.
Yes, the other Butler. The Butler did it.
Right.
The other Butler.
The other Butler. No, Richard Butler and Ed Butler, two separate people. This Ed, although very similar in their viewpoints, this Ed Butler is a man with some very suspicious links to the Kennedy assassinations, both of them, and the Information Council of the Americas is his group. INCA's links to both Oswald and the U.S. government were considerable. INCA's president was the famous Dr. Alton Ochsner, as Dave mentioned. I'm just putting in here that is the father of the man who was involved with David Duke in this pro-Somoza, anti-Sandinista group. INCA's president was the famous Dr. Alton Ochsner, a consultant to the U.S. Air Force, quote, on the medical side of subversive matters, unquote. Ochsner, a friend of the Somozas, was later identified as, quote, the first man to uncover Oswald's pro-communist activities, unquote, from unexplained first-hand impressions. Ochsner also sponsored a local journal, Latin American Report, whose editor, William G. Godet, admitted a CIA connection and also was issued the Mexican travel permit immediately preceding Oswald's. At least three of INCA's backers and Cuban employees had previously been associated with a CIA-backed Cuban Revolutionary Council at 544 Camp Street. More important, the Riley family, Eustace Riley of INCA, William Riley of the CRC Crusade, were Oswald's ostensible employers in New Orleans. Another INCA charter member, William I. Monahan, an ex-FBI agent, joined the Riley Company about the same time Oswald apparently did, and soon became the chief source of information to the FBI and Secret Service about Oswald's activities with the company.
Okay, now, again, of the paramilitary milieu, which appears to be very much an M.O. with the Reagan administration, in connection with the Bay of Pigs, Cuban Fry Corps, as we call it, the paramilitary milieu put together to get rid of Castro, we took a look at Robert K. Brown. Robert K. Brown along was approached by a man named Stanley Drennan, again, part of this Aryan Nation's far-right group, and approached in connection with an assassination plot against President Kennedy and testified before the Warren Commission. Well, Robert K. Brown has come a long way. He now, of course, is the editor-in-chief of Soldier of Fortune, and that magazine, too, has been very much involved with the Contra effort and the covert action, the paramilitary effort in Central America. Reading from the New York Times of September 23, 1985, Soldier Journal Eyes Respectability, article by Ivor Peterson. 10 years ago, a men's adventure magazine rejected Robert K. Brown's proposal to write a piece about a mercenary in the Rhodesian Army. They said they were getting away from the hairy-chested stuff, Mr. Brown recalled. But Mr. Brown thought hairy-chested adventure was a saleable item with American men, so he launched Soldier of Fortune, the journal of the professional adventurer. From a 40-page black-and-white quarterly, Soldier of Fortune has grown into a glossy magazine with a 180,000 circulation. A 10-year trek to respectability was how a Soldier of Fortune brochure describes these intervening years at its 7th annual convention here this weekend. The magazine has begun to draw interest from men not a part of its usual Vietnam veteran following, men too young to vote, men too young to have known the war, and others nervous with the magazine's aggressive themes but no longer certain that accommodation is the answer. This weekend's gathering drew 800 men, twice the number that came last year, mostly in camouflage uniforms but many in civilian clothes. The Reagan administration has privately encouraged unofficial aid programs like the one conducted by the Omega Group, the magazine's parent company based in Boulder, Colorado, and it has declined to take a position on the occasional fighting some of the men associated with Soldier of Fortune have engaged in. In reply to criticism of such forays into combat, Soldier of Fortune defenders point to a long history of Americans fighting overseas without government sanction for causes they believed in, including the Lafayette Escadrille in World War I and the anti-fascist Lincoln Brigade that fought Franco in the Spanish Civil War. We prefer they don't fight, Mr. Brown said of the small Omega Group teams that have gone to Central America. Our time and effort is better spent instructing them rather than getting in firefights for them. So, Robert K. Brown, one of the members of the Cuban Freikorps, the paramilitary milieu put together to get rid of Castro, very much on the scene today, and part of the Nicaraguan Freikorps, I guess you could say, that is currently being employed to try and get rid of the Sandinistas, and a primary exponent of Freikorps methodology.
Okay, talking about the Reagan administration's agenda, and also at the same time tipping our hand ever so slightly as to probably what we're going to be talking about in the next Radio Free America.
This is actually what we're doing now, is providing a transition. We're now, what we're going to be doing in our next Radio Free America is kind of pulling the camera back and showing how the Aryan Nations fits into a larger international fascist milieu, and specifically the World Anti-Communist League.
Absolutely. And as mentioned, we're going to tip you off a little bit here with a couple of the things that still tie in with the Reagan administration. This is from an article entitled The Old Right's New Crusade. It's from the October 22nd, 1979.
No, 1985.
October 22nd, 1985 edition of the Village Voice. The article is by Joe Connison and Murray Waas, W-A-A-S, and it goes like this. Hobbled by Congress in its pursuit of a proxy war against the Sandinista government in Nicaragua, the Reagan administration has turned to the private sector. With the encouragement and possible direction of the White House's National Security Council, private groups, partly funded by the governments of other countries, have provided military and police training to the Salvadoran military, as well as shipments of food, medicine, and combat gear to the Nicaraguan Contra rebels. Money has also been raised abroad for the purchase of weapons by the Contras. The level of private aid is estimated to be as high as $25 million a year. The network collecting and distributing aid to the Contras includes much of the traditional American far right, from the old China lobby and the John Birch Society to the Moonies and the Cuban exiles. But at its center is a little-known international propaganda outfit called the World Anti-Communist League. WACL, W-A-C-L, funded by the governments of Taiwan, South Korea, Saudi Arabia, and Paraguay, and by large private contributors in the U.S. and abroad. Chaired by retired Major General John K. Singlaub, whose own affiliations could form a far-right directory, WACL met in Dallas last month and received the President's blessing for a renewed Cold War crusade. Skipping down. For the first time since its founding in 1968, WACL, again the World Anti-Communist League, appears to have a purpose beyond its annual reunions for far-rightists from around the world. In years past, delegates from free and, quote, captive nations gathered beneath the blazing torch on WACL's banner to debate the struggle against international communism and to dream of unleashing the nationalist Chinese and the Ukrainian freedom fighters. This year, such traditional obsessions were shunted aside in favor of a more fashionable notion, quote, low-intensity warfare against Marxist governments in the Third World. Guerrillas from Nicaragua and Afghanistan displayed the evidence of real battle, and when Nelson Bunker Hunt and other prominent Dallas reactionaries showed up, they got more than just another speech. The one-legged Contra had company, a real Afghan Mujahid, complete with burned stumps below the elbows. Elements that made up the original wackle were present, of course. Knots of nationalist Chinese, unable to converse with other delegates. Slavic emigres, disgruntled because nearly everyone else has given up on rolling back the borders of the East Bloc. Old right red-baiters like Robert Morris, former counsel to the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee. But these remnants were dominated, both politically and stylistically, by the new idols of anti-communism. The civilian military assistance mercenary types from Alabama, who provided security for the Dallas conference and acknowledged Singlaub as their mentor. The general says he has asked them to avoid direct mercenary activities like the embarrassing border incident in Nicaragua last year in which two CMA members were killed. Skipping down, the U.S. continued to be represented in WACL, World Anti-Communist League, however, by Dr. Roger Pearson, a British, quote, scientific racist, an anti-Semitic publicist based in Washington. Although Pearson embarrassed even WACL, which ousted him in 1980, he received a letter in 1982 from President Reagan on White House stationery, praising his, quote, substantial contributions to promoting those ideals and principles that we value at home and abroad, unquote. Namely, presumably, scientific racism. That letter, which Pearson used in subsequent fundraising, has never been repudiated by the administration. Pearson's role in WACL was covered extensively by the Washington Post when WACL convened in the nation's capital in 1978. The Post account, by Paul Valentine, identified dozens of neo-Nazi, fascist, and racist leaders there, including former American Nazi William Pierce, Italian fascist Giorgio Almirante, South African racial theorist Ivor Benson, and Willis Carto of the Liberty Lobby. Paraguay hosted many of the same characters at the 1979 meeting in Asunción. Skipping down, despite the purge of Pearson, WACL was not particularly clean in 1981 when Singlaub headed the U.S. delegation to the 14th WACL conference in Taipei. The Mexican anti-Semites and Latin American fascist groups led by Raimundo Guerrero, already well known to Pasoni and the other U.S. members, were still present, as were former Nazi intelligence officer Dr. Theodor Oberlander, West German far-rightist Alfred Gehlen, and the Cuban terrorists. No action was taken against any of these groups until columnist Jack Anderson publicly exposed the anti-Semitism of the Mexican group and the role of WACL, through its Latin wing CAL, in death squad activities throughout Central and South America. In the wake of Anderson's revelations, CAL was expelled in January 1984 at CAL, that's the Latin American branch, but the core of the old Latin fascist apparatus still remains.
Okay, you're listening to KFJC Los Altos Hills. We're almost finished here with Radio Free America. A couple of the key names there, Robert Morris. We looked at him in connection with Conservatism USA, a group which brought up a bunch of Army intelligence agents from Munich to Dallas, Texas. Of course, William Pierce we've looked at extensively tonight, key member of Aryan Nations, author of the Turner Diaries, and Theodor Oberlander is a fellow we're going to be looking at extensively in our discussion about the World Anti-Communist League, and we're going to intersect that with the Gehlen organization in particular. I'm going to read you just a very short section here, again, continuing with a little bit of discussion about the World Anti-Communist League. One of the people that we looked at in our last broadcast, number 11, as a member of a group called the Committee to Preserve the Monroe Doctrine, was a man named Lev Dobryansky. He is a member, basically, is a Ukrainian emigre, and very close to many of the Eastern European and Soviet emigres who have been such a very leading part of the Gehlen organization over the years. Reading a very short section from an article called Reagan and the War Crimes Lobby. And by the way, we're going to be taking up the World Anti-Communist League and these Village Voice articles at greater length and in more detail when we begin our next Radio Free America show, which will be, by the way, on January 14th. Anyway, a short section of an article called Reagan and the War Crimes Lobby. This is from the Village Voice of May 14th, 1981. 1985, and about Lev Dobryansky and his association not only with the World Anti-Communist League, which he helped form, but also with many of the members of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations who we looked at in connection with the people who met Oswald and the World Anti-Communist League that we've been looking at for a long time. Of course, the Latin American affiliate, we looked at Maurice Gatlin from 544 Camp Street and his role in forming that. But of Lev Dobryansky, currently Reagan's ambassador to the United Nations, and his role in forming WACL. And again, remember, Dobryansky is a member of the Committee to Restore the Monroe Doctrine, a Birch-sponsored group that we looked at in our last show. From the Voice of May 14th, a leading figure among the rightist émigrés, is Dr. Lev Dobryansky, Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas and chairman of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, UCCA, and the Captive Nations Committees, Incorporated. Dobryansky, whose daughter Paula serves on the staff of the National Security Council, is also board chairman of a leading émigré publication, the Ukrainian Quarterly. Another is Yaroslav Stetsko, chairman of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, and, for a brief time in the summer of 1941, premier of the Independent Republic of the Ukraine. Stetsko, an elder statesman of the international far right, was received by the White House in July of 1983 by the President and Vice President George Bush. He and Dobryansky also helped to create the World Anti-Communist League, WACL, the organizational haven for neo-Nazis, fascists, and anti-Semitic extremists from two dozen countries, formerly headed by racial theorist Roger Pearson, and of course that WACL is centrally involved in the Contra effort, the Nicaraguan Freikorps that we've been talking about. Now, Nip's going to read you a short section about some of these same characters from Peter Dale Scott's essay, Government Documents in the JFK Assassination.
Okay, and it goes like this. Nelson Bunker Hunt, meanwhile, had become the Texas representative of a German-based intelligence network, the ICDCC, or International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, which paradoxically united many of the CIA's most prominent opponents within the United States, most notably China lobbyist General Charles Willoughby, General MacArthur's former G2 in Japan and Korea, with representatives from CIA-sponsored organizations abroad, such as the Ukrainians cultivated by the Galen Organization. One chairman of the ICDCC, Hermann Punder, was a former Abwehr agent and close ally of Galen's sponsors, Konrad Adenauer and Hermann Obst of the Deutsche Bank, while a later chairman, Theodor Oberländer, was close to the right-wing German émigré group to whose newspaper General Walker spoke by long-distance telephone on November 22, 1963, transmitting the story, accepted by the Warren Report, that Oswald had shot at Walker in April 1963.
And again, our last show, we talked, in Radio Free America number 11, we talked about that at considerable length. And also in Radio Free America number 2, we talked about the émigré office headed by Dr. Walter Becker. That's the reference there. That basically winds the program up for this evening. I'd like to conclude with one short article. We talked about this. I read it at the conclusion of one of the Hard Rain tapes that was contained in the broadcast. And I think at this point, listeners may be able to share the special horror that I personally feel when I read this article and think about how literally David Duke must mean his words here. And again, I think most people reading this think that somehow he's being cute or using a literary device. I think he was being very literal. Research credit to Ted Rubenstein for this article from the Las Vegas Sun of October 28th, 1983. Ex-KKK leader reveals 79 plot for invasion, New Orleans. A former Ku Klux Klan leader Thursday revealed for the first time that he put some mercenaries of the deposed Prime Minister Eric Gehry in touch with some KKK members for an invasion of Grenada in 1979, but the plan was aborted in favor of a plot against neighboring Dominica. Breaking a four-year silence on the plot, David Duke, former Grand Wizard of the KKK, discussed the events in an interview with UPI and demanded freedom in jail for a Klansman who plotted against Prime Minister Eugenia Charles of Dominica. Duke, who was questioned by the federal grand jury that indicted Don Black and nine others, said, quote, "The Grenada invasion is a vindication of Don Black and the other valiant men who were arrested and prosecuted by overzealous federal agents for daring to fight against communism. I think it's a gross injustice that Mr. Black is imprisoned for trying to do courageously as a private citizen what President Reagan is trying to do today."
And with that, we're going to leave you with the words and music of Richard and Mimi Farina while you think about all that we've talked about tonight and Dave's last article there. And we will see you, of course, during the regular One Step Beyond broadcast and on the next Radio Free America, January 14th. from 7 to 11 p.m. On behalf of Dave Emery and all of the sterling research that he did, this is Nip Tuck thanking you for joining us on this edition of Radio Free America right here on KFJC Los Altos Hills 89.7 on your FM radio dial.